some lectures, and then there was more time for the questions. So, just to recall this. Okay, this is about going to some place in material universe. And we say sometimes that we come to Vrindavan, but we really don't enter Vrindavan. Because the Vrindavan, what we with these senses can see, it's not the real Vrindavan here near Delhi. Is it the same analogy when we look at the moon with the telescope and so on, and we see and dust and so on? Is it the same analogy that we with these senses cannot see because it is the planet of demigods which are from five dimensions and we cannot see this? Is it the same analogy or?
Well, I think there's two parts to that, at least two. One is that when we look at the moon with the telescope, they say that even if you pile 20 elephants on, or 200 elephants on top of each other, you wouldn't be able to see it with your telescope, with the best telescope we have. And that's considering their understanding of how far the moon is, which we don't really necessarily accept. So there may be a limitation on our ability, even though with our mundane vision, for instance, with a telescope, maybe you can, with a telescope or some kind of scope with their present insufficient vision, you might be able to see something, say, a kilometer away. It's not a question of consciousness, it's just a question of limitations of material vision. And on the other hand, even if we could, even if we had a telescope which was adequate to see what's actually going on the moon planet, it doesn't mean that necessarily we'd see what was going on the moon planet. But it's assured, when the scientists tell us that the moon is just composed of some craters or something like that, and it's just dust, and that's what they see with their telescope. The Prabhupada would give the example that many scientists know that the source of energy for the vegetation on this planet is the moon. They have almanacs which tell us when's the proper time to plant, when's the proper time to harvest the vegetables, because they know that the moon is supplying the energy for the growth of vegetables. So how is it possible that dust could actually provide life for the vegetables on this planet? Besides that, how is it that dust is reflecting light from the sun? If you take some dust in your room, how much light can it reflect? So, just from the practical sense point of view, their description of the moon planet is obviously fallacious. It's inconsistent with our present observation. Now, they can't really see what's going on the moon with their present vision, even with their best telescopes. But from a practical point of view, we can understand it's not possible that the moon is just composed of dust, just from our own observations. Now, as far as what's going on in Vrindavan, when one has, just like when Arjuna, he changed his vision, but actually he changed his vision to a lower vision in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. He changed it from spiritual vision of seeing Krishna, he changed it to seeing Krishna's universal form, which is a vision of the demigods. It wasn't a higher vision, it was actually a lower vision. But we don't even have that vision. We can't even see like the demigod sees things. Sometimes people take some drug or something and then they get some revelation that they're not actually seeing things properly. So, of course, that means that they're somehow or another able to see from a different perspective. But we ourselves, we don't really see what's going on here with our present vision, because it's covered, just like when you put yellow tinted glasses over your eyes, then everything appears to be yellow. So similarly, when our vision becomes purified, at least we will see things as they actually are here in this material world. At least we'll come gradually to the vision of the demigods and actually see what's going on here. But that doesn't mean that we'll necessarily see transcendence. Transcendence is another realm of consciousness which goes beyond liberation. That's revelation that has to be revealed to us. So what's actually going on in Vrindavan has to be revealed to us. It's not just a question of purification of vision. It's a question of revelation. And that's qualification by devotional service.
Well, I was just thinking that. What color is Krishna?
They say it's a color of. This is the closest to this black monsoon clouds.
Blue.
The closest.
Bluish
color.
Black.
Yeah.
But back to Siddhanta Saraswati, when he's giving his commentary in the Brahma Samhita, he mentions there that that blue, that color of Krishna, is not any color that you've ever seen in the material world. It's not equivalent to the blue, what we think is blue. So, as Maharaj was saying, it's a question of revelation. You can only understand Krishna's true nature when he decides to... Revelation means that it's shown to you. It's not something that you can take or grasp or earn. It's just
descending down,
displayed to you. So, Vrindavan, there are descriptions of Vrindavan, Chintamani, it's this, amazing place where there's a description of Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. The area underneath the mountain, it's all bejeweled and, it's fabulously opulent. But when we see Govardhan Hill, we just see a heap of rocks. If we take a Govardhan Shila, we don't see Krishna, generally. I don't see a rock. I know the Govardhan Shila is none different from Krishna, from the authority of Shastra and my spiritual master. But I don't know it from the authority of my own perception. So our own perceptions, are very, very limited. And the tendency to place value on our sense perceptions limits our ability to properly understand things as they are. Just like a scientist, they have their telescopes, or let's say, they've got, what's this big thing that they have, begins with H? What's the name of the last telescope they shot up in the air there?
Refractor.
No. I'm saying there's a name for
I
just forget it now. Anyway, they put this telescope. It's not a telescope, actually. It's a radioscope. It works off radio beams. Or radiation. But the point is that the information that they gather, with those instruments has to be interpreted. First of all, it has to gather information according to the criteria set by their own limited sense perceptions. You can't build a machine to see something that you don't know exists. So they're looking for stuff that's already within their own perceptual range. They build a machine which can only detect things within their own perceptual range. And when the information comes in, they have to interpret it according to their own perceptual experience. So even though they say that they're looking to the far distance, the universe, actually what they're looking for is just stuff that they can see here. They're not looking for stuff that they've never seen before. So sense perception is a very, very poor way of gathering information, that's the point. Although, obviously there are things out there in the universe. So I have to understand them. So the only way that you can do that is by revelation. It has to be shown to you. In the same way that Krishna showed Arjuna his universal form. That's not a form, by the way, that's a real form, but it was a form, it was a display that Krishna put on for Arjuna. It's not something that people normally see. So... when we talk about, Vrindavan, back to Siddhanta Saraswati used to say, you cannot purchase a ticket to go to Vrindavan. there was some disciple that he sent on a preaching mission somewhere, and then instead of going where he was supposed to, he went to Vrindavan. He was curious. So then when he came back, oh, I've seen Vrindavan, back to Siddhanta Saraswati, he said, you have never seen Vrindavan. So the spiritual perceptions of things are a lot different from the way that we normally see.
Vishaya, Charya, when will my mind become purified of all material contamination so that I can actually enter into Vrindavan?
Yes. Does that answer your question?
Partially.
Why? What's wrong with that?
Let's say it's wrong. I'm just trying to understand because on the moon, what we can see and from here and from the pictures which are sent from there, because there are already. I'm not talking about people who came to there. I don't know if they came or not. 69. Or there are controversy about it. Not even in a Karmi world there is a controversy about this. But they sent the small. Machines which came there, and they are going all around, and then they're sending pictures from there, also from Mars and so on. But the pictures are like it's far from being a heavenly planet. So what I'm just asking, is it that you can send somewhere there, and then you cannot see because it's not
visible by
yes, it's not visible by our eyes in our third-dimensional world. You need to be a higher being to see. And I remember also when I read, I think it was King of Knowledge, Raja Vidya, long time ago, that Srila Prabhupada also said something, but even if they came there, they would not be able to see anything, something like this. So that's why I'm asking
if you put an ant on the floor in this meeting right now, do you think that he'd be able to see, you know, Leela Super Prabhu there operating his video camera?
No.
Yeah. Or just even us sitting here talking, you'd be totally unaware that there's even a conversation going on here. So in the same way, the demigods are living on their planets, including the moon planet, and they're doing, you know, living their lives, and they have their particular abilities. In some planets, you know, people are born with cities, which means they can transport from one planet to another in an instant, no problem. There's no barrier for them. Yeah, we can't even get out of the outer atmosphere of this planet. So, your body limits you. Prabhupada also gave the example of a bull tied to a stake. Yeah, so it walks, and it's walking and walking, and he thinks it's walking a really long way. But actually, it's just going around in circles because it can't break out of the limitations that's been imposed on it. So in the same way, let's say the Bhagavatam describes it on this planet, just a little higher than the surface of the earth, there's the Buddhas, ghostly classes. So they're living in the same space that we do. But generally, we don't see them, because we don't have the perceptive ability. You know. And similarly, we can't walk through a wall. To us, that seems solid, but it's not. A ghost can pass through any, you know, so-called solid object with no problem, because it's, you know, its body is different from the one that we have. Even in quantum mechanics, they'll tell you that there's no such thing as a solid object. Depends on how you perceive it. So, you know, there's different ways, even in science, of perceiving things. So there's not actually anything solid, it's just flows of energy and combinations of particles. If you know how to penetrate them, sound can penetrate, you know, a solid object. But we can't, you know, in these bodies. So we can't rely, the point that Prabhupada always made is that we cannot rely on our own sense perception. And the scientists are ordinary people just like us. Yeah. So when you read their descriptions of when they went to the moon, you never went to the moon. I never went to the moon. Who went there? They say one or two people went. What did they see? They brought back some dust, which is exactly the same as the dust that you can find in the Arizona desert. So where did they really go? I mean, you have to question that. Yeah. So we shouldn't put our faith so much in so-called intelligent, you know, human beings. They're actually, you know, very limited, like the bull. Prabhupada said, you know, because Tamal Krishna Maharaj was having a conversation, and Prabhupada said that he had seen a mountain that went so far high in the sky that you couldn't see the end of it, and they were flying over the Alps. He told me that. He said it was so high, he was up in the aeroplane. He said, but the mountain was so high. But if you ask any aeroplane pilot flying that route, they would have probably told you that they'd never seen such a mountain. But Prabhupada saw it, because he had transcendental senses. And when Tamal Krishna Maharaj kind of raised this objection, but we don't see that, Prabhupada said, that's because you were prejudiced. You were prejudiced. Yeah, that means you have your own idea and you're trying to make everything fit within your idea of what's acceptable, what's perceptible, what's truth, what's not. But we don't know anything. We don't know what the truth is. That's the whole point. So therefore we have to have a higher authority, and we have it revealed to us. And if you're open to it, then you do actually begin to perceive things on a different level. But there's a process to get to that point where you become qualified for that.
I think even on the directly perceivable platform, if you just take the example that Prabhupada used sometimes also, that the moon is reflecting the light of the sun. So the so-called astronauts went there. There's enough evidence, empirical evidence, to show that they really didn't go there. But if you say that they sent some kind of rocket ship that was supposedly on the moon, did they discover anything different than what the so-called astronauts had discovered when they went there? No. So then, how is it possible that the moon is made out of dust and yet is reflecting all this light back to the Earth? You take a handful of dust and put it before a light, is it going to, before an extremely intense light, is it going to reflect anything off the dust?
Maybe if it is phosphor.
What's that?
If it is phosphor dust. Phosphorus.
Yeah, but they don't say that the moon is made, they just say it's dust. Yeah.
It's dust in the rocks. In the rocks.
Yeah, I've seen one of those rocks.
Did you ever go to the Space Center?
Yeah.
NASA.
Just go in there.
It's just an ordinary rock. It doesn't look any different from any other rock.
Rocks don't reflect light either unless they're polished. But they don't say, they quite do that. Anyhow, it doesn't make any sense. If you go to an almanac, even not a Vedic almanac, a Western almanac, they tell you the phase of the moon on the planet. They put plants into the ground because the moon is supplying the juice of life to the vegetables. So how is it possible rocks, or hold a rock before a vegetable and see how much life the rock gets from the life the vegetable gets from the rock? So does it make any sense? Does it make sense to you that rocks are supplying energy to vegetables on this planet? Mm-hmm. So there's some contradiction there. So if you... The scientists don't mind having contradictions, but we do. I mean, the material world is made out of foolish people who blindly accept, you know, what other people say. But we don't have to be so foolish. Now, we, as Harisar Prabhu said, his father said, we never went to the moon. Nor do we know anyone who actually went to the moon. So it's a question of accepting either the contradictory statements made by the scientists or the authority of the Vedas. But we don't know the Vedas. All the Vedas have told us is that, for instance, there's certain things that we do know, that we're not the body. Isn't that right? The body's changing, but the soul isn't. Very simple thing. Anyone with a little common sense should be able to perceive that. But these great scientists, they don't know that. So what do they actually know? They can't even understand the difference between themselves and their body. what is the actual extent of their knowledge? Now we don't have that. We don't know empirical science, but I doubt whether they're jugglery. You know, they actually know that much really about what they're talking about either, since they keep on changing it all the time. Light is a wave. Light is a particle. Light is a wavicle. Light is whatever they come up with the next year or the next decade. So why should we accept them? At least the Vedas tell us that we're not this body. They tell us that there's a person who's controlling everything. So that's a lot more knowledge than getting around the scientists. And that's perceivable by us. So the Vedas, from our perception, from what we know of them, is more consistent with our reality. And the scientists' understanding is not very consistent. But we're not in a position, you know, either to try to prove, you know, the scientists never went there, or if they did, you know, what they perceived. But no, from our experience, the moon is giving off light, is reflecting an enormous amount of light, otherwise it looks like the sun at night practically. And it's giving life to the vegetables. So from our experience, the moon is something different from what they describe it.
May I rephrase the question? So, we know that the moon is the heavenly planet, and it's full of life, and everything there, how it's described, and nice nature, and so on. Say that we have telescopes that we can see quite well there. We could come closer to this in the distance that we can see it. Imagine, in this very body, with these very senses. Would we be able to see it or not? Or we would just see something, you know, empty? This is the question.
It's a simple question.
Any question? It's a good question.
If we have this, maybe that, you know, this is all bogus. Deal with reality. Deal with the fact that you have a three-dimensional body with three-dimensional senses. You're not going to perceive anything beyond three dimensions. These bodies are not designed to do that. If you want to see any higher perceptions, then you have to put your consciousness on a higher level. Yeah, that's yoga. Yeah, I had a discussion with Sariputta Prabhu, and we were talking about, you know, the process of yoga, and how yogis actually can move from one place to another instantly at will. Now, I once asked Srila Prabhupada, because I'd heard that yogis, you know, they take bath in the Ganga, they come up again in the Jamuna, they go down, they come up again in the Saraswati, like this. All in one day, they bathe in every holy river. So I was thinking, how do they do that? It must be, you know, that in their subtle form, you know, they go into meditation and then they subtly move. You know, that's possible. So I asked Srila Prabhupada, and he said, no, in that body, that physical body that they have, they actually are able to go to all the different holy rivers and bathe in them every day. So that's a different science. It's possible you can develop, even in this body, to a point, you know, where you break the barriers of, you know, 3D, three dimensions. But there's a process for doing that. It's not just, you know, well, let's just say for argument's sake, we can't see the moon. You can't. If you develop the right process and develop your senses and consciousness in the proper way by yoga, then there are so-called amazing things that can be done. They're only amazing to us because we can't do them. Yeah. But to the person that's doing them, they're quite ordinary. So the yogis, they can actually... There's like these cities that you develop, yeah, in mystic yoga. If you do the mystic yoga practice, as you develop in mystic yoga, your senses develop, your consciousness develops, and there are abilities that come with that development. So let's say Prachi City. Yeah. Even now there are yogis in India. They can reach out. Prabhupada gave this example. Some man that he knew, he could get pomegranates, you know, pomegranate, what do they call that here?
Yeah, the
No.
Yeah, they grow in the Himalayas, so he could reach out from Calcutta and pick some pomegranates and bring them back.
Oh, from Afghanistan.
That's in the Himalayas, what it was.
Oh.
It's up in the mountains. Anyway, the point is that he could do that. He could just reach out and pick them and bring them back. Now, nobody will believe you if you say that. There's another example. There was a yogi in Allahabad, and he used to sit in the street naked and meditate. So the mundane people sometimes, they would complain, this fellow sitting naked, it's not right, should stop him. So the police arrested him, they put him in jail. The next morning, they opened up the cell, he was gone. They went back, he was sitting in the same place. Yeah, that's, what's that? Smaller than the smallest? Lagu? No, that's lighter than the lightest. Yeah. And, I forget, the Animesha Pramti or something?
Mahima?
Anima City. Becoming smaller than the smallest. You can actually physically shrink your size down so you can ride on the sunbeams. Mystic yogis do that. So there is a process that you can do that, and the way that that happens is that Krishna is everywhere as the super soul. He's within every atom. He's within your own heart. So the mystic yoga process is to meditate on the super soul. And as you get closer and closer to realizing the presence of the super soul, these abilities automatically develop. Why? Because the super soul is everywhere. And as you come in contact with the super soul, he gives you access, according to his desire, to other places or other dimensions. So that's all by the grace of Krishna. So these, you know, mystic cities are effects. But if we tell these stories, nobody will believe it.
An example is that in London, in the middle of the 1800s, one man, he called the top scientists in Europe to a hotel, including the co-founder of evolution with Darwin. And they all watched him. He walked out the window of the second floor of the hotel and walked around. And all the top scientists in Europe reported that they actually observed that. And not one scientist in America would believe them. They said it was all a fabrication. So, you know,
that was... And I think a Nobel Prize winner was there. Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe a Nobel Prize.
But as soon as he reported this extraordinary activity, the other scientists have just seen, now he's gone mad.
So they select, as Kudakarma and Satipudra Prabhu pointed out, it's called selective filtering of knowledge. I mean, they have people who can, with their mind, bend spoons, which is not a big thing, but according to the scientists, it would be possible. But someone can take a spoon, solid spoon, just with his mind bending. And there are people who, in front of exhibitions, have manifested people just from their mental ability. So we don't really know. I mean, so many people, for instance, they have even little tiny mystic powers like Reiki. They can put their hand, everyone has that. You hurt your hand, you put your other hand in front of it, then gradually the pain goes away a little bit because you're projecting energy onto it. But the scientists will say it's impossible. They say it's impossible that there can be a soul. They say so many things. So we have a little bit more idea than they do, but we don't really know what's going on. I mean, I know, for instance, people can do Reiki from a distance and actually, you know, help people from a distance. They actually feel the presence of that energy. So the scientists will say it's impossible. But it's going on.
I'll give you a good example of somebody who's determined to be an illusion. My brother, my elder brother, he's a first-class atheist. Because there's nothing first-class about being an atheist, but he's a determined atheist. So he told me a year or two ago, he had some heart attack. So he collapsed, he was out. Then they had to actually bring the ambulance, they got the paddles out, you know, they're getting the shock, and it actually, you know, brought him back. So he told me that he had had this experience of being out of his body looking down at it. So he explained that, because he's adamantly opposed to any idea of the soul or anything, you know, beyond the senses. So he said, actually, that all that was just chemical reactions in my brain caused by the heart attack, which gave the illusion of me thinking that I was up in the air looking down. Now, when I became a devotee, or just before I became a devotee in England, I had an experience, similar thing. I left my body just momentarily, but I was out in the room and I was looking down. I could see my own body lying on the bed. I could see my friends sitting around chatting, completely unaware of what was happening to me. I was out, and I knew I was out. And then I went back in, and then I spent half an hour or an hour trying to get back out again. But it was an experience, and I knew that I was not in my body, that I was outside of it. But at that time, I didn't have any knowledge about, you know, that we're not this body. I had no information at all to support what I'd experienced. I just knew what I experienced. And that basically led me to look and try and find out what was going on, you know, what was going on and what reality really is. So both of us had a similar experience, but because he's so determined to deny the existence of God, the existence of the soul, therefore even when something happens to him, he can't believe it. He has to make some mundane explanation to fit it within, you know, his mental framework. Otherwise, he has to admit that he was wrong. So his ego is so big that he can't do that. For me, when that happened to me, it blew me away. I was an atheist at that point. But after that, I just thought, well, what's going on? I have to find out. So, you know, yoga, you can develop your consciousness, and there are things that can be perceived by the mercy of the Supreme Lord if you qualify yourself. But if we remain determined, you know, just like this whole debate that's going on the last 10 years about intelligent design, you're familiar with that, yeah? So the scientists that are proposing intelligent design are doing it on the basis of actual scientific findings. They've, you know, employed the same methodology. They've looked into the cells and the atoms and this and that. And they've seen that, first of all, mathematically, what they're seeing could never have been formed, you know, by chance, by random interactions, because it's so intricate and it's so amazing in its, you know, construction. And there are so many component parts that mathematically, any real mathematician will tell you that Darwin's idea, you know, of chance, you know, random selection, is completely bogus. Mathematically, it's an impossibility. So the intelligent design people, they saw the same thing that other scientists are seeing, but they were willing to admit that the idea of evolution, you know, random selection, blah, 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 does not account for what we're actually seeing. So then what is the other possibility? So then they came up with this concept of intelligent design. But there's other scientists who are adamantly opposed to it. Yeah? Not because the facts don't show what they're saying, but because their paradigm for understanding it is now being disturbed. They're so attached to this idea of evolution that they take it as an axiomatic truth. You know, a person like Richard Dawkins, right, that idiot from England, he makes the statement that life is so amazing that we can't actually explain it. So just see how wonderfully matter is working. That's his, you know, so he admits he can't explain it, but he is so attached to this idea that there's no God that he keeps on insisting that it's somehow or another some mystical, you know, miracle, miraculous happening of, you know, nature. And there's no consciousness, there's no guide to it, there's no intelligence to it, even though everything is so incredibly intricately put together that chance cannot explain it. So people have their predispositions, and according to our predisposition, we'll accept or reject information as it comes to us. And if we're open, you'll see that whatever you're perceiving, you'll go beyond that, and there'll be something more, and something more, and something more, and something more. So that way, then, you learn more and more. But if you're fixed on a particular idea, and then you insist on interpreting the information that's coming in to fit into your predisposed idea, then what are you going to learn? So many scientists nowadays are like that. They're not real scientists. They're prejudiced. Yeah, they're bogus. They take information, they twist the meaning of it around and misrepresent it. Fortunately, there are some now that are starting to wake up and admit, hey, you know, what we're seeing doesn't fit with this theory of evolution. And if you go out and tell most people that you don't believe in evolution, they all think that you're a crackpot, even nowadays. It's got such a hold on people's consciousness, this whole idea of evolution, chemical combination, that, you know, people accept it as an axiomatic gospel truth. It's become a religion of its own, under the definition of blind faith. They have blind faith in evolution. So it's very difficult to dialogue with such people. So our proposition is that you just see things as they are, that's all. And even then, what we're seeing, as Maharaj says, we're not seeing hardly anything. You know, this whole universe. The scientists admit 95% is either dark energy or dark matter. About 5% of the, you know, so-called known universe is perceivable to us. Actually, they think it's perceivable. That even then is not true. But they admit 95% of the substance of the universe, the stuff of the universe, they describe as dark energy and dark matter. It's dark because they don't know what it is. Right? So they admit they don't know what 95% of the universe is, but if it, and if you try to say that it's actually the creation or energy of God, no, 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 it can't be that. How reasonable is that? When you admit you don't know what everything is, you don't know where it came from, you don't know how it's working, and then somebody says, well, it's working because of the superconsciousness acting upon it. No, 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 no way. They're all bogus. They're not scientists. Prabhupada said that those who are spiritually investigators, if you like, they're real scientists. Because they take the information that's there and then they try to understand it with an open mind.
Any other questions?
Can we understand it the same way that our progressing spiritual life is also like so many revelations on that path? Like uplifting your consciousness means one point also revelation to come to another stage, no?
Oh. It's a question of using our intelligence. I mean, in one sense, Krishna is giving us revelation. That means if we hear what reality is and we act according to that reality, then gradually we'll perceive that reality. So that's all revelation, because Tadami Buddhi Ogam Tam. Krishna said, I'm the one who's giving you intelligence even to do that. All being supplied by Krishna, according to our sincerity, according to our desire. It's all revelation. There's nothing in this universe but revelation. Krishna, everyone's dependent completely on Krishna, either to remember him or to forget him.
So the other thing depends just on the desire. If you have desire, then revelation.
Desire, and your desire is insufficient. You also have to work according to that. You also have to. We can desire, but then we also have to deserve.
also you have to have a genuine source of guidance or information. There are people that have desire. They want to know something more, but then they somehow or another they go to a bogus person who misdirects them. So therefore the guru, genuine guru, you have to go to somebody who's seen the truth, not a bogus person. Then if you're ready yourself to receive information, then and you have an authorized person that knows the truth, then that combination will actually result in your revelation.
Or at least someone who repeats the words of someone who knows the truth.
But if you have genuine desire, then the genuine spiritual master will come.
It's not, people don't get genuine desires just out of the air. But if you actually have Krishna knows our sincerity.
Yeah.
So we're somewhat sincere, then Krishna will bring arrangements accordingly. But sincerity is developed. It's not that a conditioned soul is born sincere. It's born sincere to follow the senses, or maybe due to some good fortune to follow some higher authority, either in the past life or by some good fortune coming in contact with a higher authority in this lifetime. And as much as he follows their instructions, then he develops his sincerity. But there's not, in the material world, there's not, people are not absolutely sincere about spiritual life. They're sincere about spiritual life as much as they've heard, understood, accepted, and followed. To that extent, they become sincere.
That's faith. I know it's right now. You have to, at the beginning, you have to have a little faith, or that sincerity. Or if some people, they're doing something that's, helping them, obviously. Let me see what it is. Let me make an inquiry. That's the beginning of faith. But that faith has to come up to the point of Nishtha, where it becomes so solid that you can't be butched. In the beginning, faith is very pliable, very easily disturbed. That's the Kanistha stage. But by following the process properly, then gradually that faith will increase, that sincerity, if you like, will increase, and it will come to a point where it becomes rock solid. Yeah. And then at that point, then there's this attachment. And then all the different stages are described there. You get ruchi, you get some real happiness, some real taste from it, and then you can't give it up. But in the beginning stages, our faith is very shaky. We get disturbed very easily. So we need guidance, we need a lot of help to get us through those stages. Therefore, Bhajan and Kriya, you have to be initiated into the process, you have to follow the process, and not in the vritti. And then all the disturbing things in the heart, the obstacles, things that cause obstacles in the development of that faith, then they are gradually removed by practicing. Yeah, by sincerely applying oneself to the process that's given. And when we do that, then we come to the fixed point of devotional service.
Actually, as we surrender to Krishna, then he reveals himself, and that removes the obstacles. The question of defenselessly chanting the holy name. Then Krishna, then he destroys with the light of his revelation by revealing himself, and the darkness point of ignorance is removed. Or as a blazing fire turns fire with ashes, so as when Krishna reveals himself, then the darkness of material existence goes away.
I'll give you a good example. On July 14th, 1976, Prabhupada was in New York. And a reporter came from Newsweek magazine. Newsday. And a very intelligent guy, his name was Kevin Sharp. And he was asking, questions. So at one point he started asking about how Prabhupada chooses the leaders for the movement, because during that tour there was a lot of questions from different reporters about what's going to happen when you're no longer here, because Prabhupada was old at that time physically. And Prabhupada was always saying that these boys, I'm training them all, the GBCs, they'll run everything. So how, but, and he asked, but you know, young men tend to not be wise. So he was asking, how do you choose them? You know, is that, you know, do you ask Krishna, or, you know, how does the process work? So Prabhupada told him, he said, yes, he said, a devotee always consults with Krishna. And in that way, so Rameshwar was there. And he said, well, it's like this. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that he is the intelligence in man. So if with our intelligence that we see some person is qualified for a certain job or a certain task, that's Krishna telling us. But Prabhupada said, no, it's not indirect. He said, I, you know, you ask Krishna and he tells you. And then, you know, Prabhupada said, that is for the minor devotees. Yeah. But, you know, for the advanced devotees, they're always consulting with Krishna at every moment. So, you know, we're in our state, you know, we're on that minor level. We, you know, we get inspiration or we think this is Krishna or I'm going to tell him. But Prabhupada always used to tell us, you work out in Krishna consciousness, Krishna will give you the intelligence how to do it nicely. But that's, as he said, on the minor level. Or on the advanced level, you know, Prabhupada was consulting with Krishna and, you know, making his decisions on the basis of that consultation.
But there's different stages for the conditioned soul also. In other words, the conditioned soul may use his intelligence and see things relatively clearer than others. But a devotee, even though he may not be on the stage, he can directly ask Krishna. He may ask Krishna. And then Krishna does give him intelligence, gives him remembrance, such as from Bhagavad Gita, from the authorities. And then by seeing through the authorities, he can actually see it's true. While a non-devotee doesn't access those transcendental authorities, although he may see relatively better than others due to relatively better intelligence.
Yes, I presume that answer can be in different ways. You can get the answer if you ask. Like, you know, you just open the book and then the answer is there. No?
Yes, but Prabhupada said that's for the minor devotees. It's indirect. But when you're actually on the advanced platform, Krishna is available to you for consultation. Krishna, a devotee, always consults with Krishna. That's his exact words. Not indirectly, but directly. So that's the platform that we need to come up to. So the process of sadhana bhakti is the process of gradual purification and therefore a gradual increase in revelation. But there's a point at which one comes to the, you know, actually fully purified stage.
That's the difference between the Mahabhagavat and everyone else.
That's it.
At every moment he knows exactly what Krishna's desire is. Yes.
Yes, in connection with this, sometimes I can hear Krishna's voice or answer very good, and sometimes not. And I would like that I'm secure all the time. Sometimes I feel that I have good connection.
Yeah. Well, that's natural. If somebody's actually practicing the spiritual principles, follow the principles and chant, then, yeah, there's a sense of communication
with
Krishna.
Yes.
But we have to be very careful in the early stages, because, you know, if you hear some voice, you don't necessarily know that it's...
Maybe it's not the only voice, can be feeling.
All right,
good
so
feeling,
some inspiration.
And yes. Yes, and yeah. I feel very satisfied. It's very, very good feeling.
bring us to the point of service, not that, you know, we have some experience and then we feel good. So as a matter of our sense gratification, yeah, then we're always looking for that another fix, if you like, transcendental fix. Yeah, it's like that. So we have to be very careful in the early stages. What revelation we have, what inspiration we have, we should be getting that.
Yes. Yeah,
that's part of the process of, you know, being purified.
Yes.
First of all, we should check and see that we're actually following all the spiritual principles. And then what revelations that we get, we should then check back to see if that's shastrically supported. And if it's supported by the instructions and the revelations that we get from the guru and the sadhu. So that way, yeah, what we feel internally, or we feel is our development and inspiration internally, we should always check that with the external representations of the super soul. Internally, we may feel we're getting some inspiration from the super soul, but when we're not on the Mahabhagwat platform, or we're not on the platform when we're fully freed from all material desire, then we have to check back everything that we, you know, experience or the inspirations that we get with the guru, with the sadhus, with the shastra, and then in that way then we can be certain that what we experience is what we think it is, yeah, that it is a genuine spiritual inspiration.
Yes, but I would like to go further or higher.
Yes, well, unless you want to go further, then you won't go anywhere, will you? So everybody should have that desire. I think Rupa Goswami says that the only qualification for advancement in spritual life is that lowly, you have to be very greedy for it.
Greedy for what?
You have to be greedy.
For Krishna.
Yeah, well, yes, for making advancement
in
Krishna consciousness. If you don't have that enthusiasm, patience, you know, if you don't have that strong
desire
then how do you make
then
any,
nothing.
Right, but at the same time, you know, you should be very careful not to jump ahead too far, yeah, more than what you're capable of. We have to be very careful not to take the process cheaply.
Cheaply
means that we think that we're on a high level when actually we're still addicted to some material bad habits. That is called sahajya. It means that they take things very easily.
You have to study the scriptures and assimilate the knowledge so you can develop a spiritual vision. When you see things properly, then you'll know what to do. Because even if you don't have any knowledge, you won't know who to consult with in order to verify your experience. So you have to have some knowledge even to know who to consult with. And that knowledge has to come from hearing from bona fide sources, which are based upon Shastra, Krishna's words. Because Krishna is the only one who knows everything. So it's not that Shastra is some old book that, you know, some philosophical people read.
Yes, but I also have a super soul in my heart, and I would like to rely on.
But you can't
this,
do that.
This voice.
But you don't.
Not
have.
Only Shastra. Shastra cannot say to me what shall I do now.
No, Shastra can tell you what to do now. You have to learn the Shastra. If you don't learn the Shastra, then you won't remember it. And if you don't remember it, because it's, after all, it's the super soul, he's going to talk to us first through the Shastra.
Okay.
In other words, if we assimilate the knowledge of the Shastra, then we'll see through the Shastra. That means that Krishna is talking to us through the Shastra, because after all, it was Krishna who spoke the Shastra in the first place. It is his words. So how can the super soul tell us anything different from what's in the books?
No, I think just concrete. Shall I take this job or not? Shall I be with these people, okay, or not? holy decisions. I cannot find in a Shastra.
Yes,
okay,
I can find general
advice.
You can find out in the Shastra how to make decisions.
Where?
Well, in the 13th chapter, Amadi Vama, Dambi Vama, Hinsa Shanti Arjavam, Acharya Pasanam Socham, Stirium Atma Vinigraha. That if you want to learn the process of making decisions, you have to learn the process of knowledge. Unless you cultivate knowledge, the process of knowledge, you'll never learn how to make decisions properly. Because even if you take a shower, you'll increase your intelligence if you're cleaner. So if you expect that you're going to be able to make decisions without following the process of knowledge, you're mistaken. Krishna, it depends upon coming in contact with Krishna by following his process. So unless you follow his process, you won't come in contact with him. And he's described the process in Shastra.
Okay.
And the guru, for any authorized devotee, he repeats what's in the Shastra, according to the intelligence, the realization that he's qualified. For everyone, the process of speaking in spiritual circles is that one should at once quote from the authority of what he's saying. So if we think we have some independent way of understanding things, apart from following authority, we're wrong.
Yes, but one of Krishna's virtues is to be independent. Huh?
But you're not a Krishna.
Yes, we are not. But maybe we have some part of his virtues.
Yes,
that
Prabhupada writes in the second canto, second chapter, verse 35 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that we have a minute independence. Our independence consists of either orientating our desires towards the ignorant misconception of misidentifying ourselves with the body, or orientating our desires towards the true conception of being Krishna's eternal servant. So that's our desire. We can orientate it by taking shelter of Maya, or we can orientate it by taking shelter of Krishna. But
of course,
I want
the shelter of Krishna.
Therefore,
yes.
Tas my shastram pramanam te karyam karma karam kara krotiya. Tas my shastram pramanam te karya karma grasasya yatra shastra vidyanotam karma karam. One should know what is duty and what is not duty by the direction of scripture, and knowing such direction one should act so that one can gradually become purified. So if we think, well, the devotees are repeat what's in the Shastra, so we hear from the devotees, then we'll also understand Shastra. And if we read Shastra, then we'll also understand Shastra. But there's the Bhagavat and the book Bhagavat and the devotee Bhagavat, but they're both the same. One doesn't say one thing, another say another thing, and the super soul in the heart doesn't say something different. They're all saying the same thing. So whether you hear from the book Bhagavat or the devotee Bhagavat, or you hear from Krishna in the heart, it's all the same. Should be the same. Otherwise, something is not spiritual. Something is off. Something. If you're reading the wrong book or hearing from the wrong person.
Oh yes, it can be that I hear from a wrong person. All devotees are not very high. So
and even we listen to and we hear from our so-called inspiration, it's just the result of hearing from others and following them. We don't
Where I feel inspiration?
The result of our...
By whom I feel inspiration?
No. Even we feel so-called inspiration. Just like Prabhupada said, during the day we see gold. And when we see a mountain, at night we dream of a golden mountain. So our inspiration is not coming from ourselves. Desire is a subtle form of conditioning, as Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita. That we're not independent. We take the knowledge we've acquired from others, either if there's coming from through the disciplic succession from Krishna, and we apply that, and if we apply it, then we get some inspiration coming from Krishna, because we've applied the proper knowledge.
Yes.
Now, we may take knowledge from others, and according to the mode of nature they're in, either we'll become bewildered, or we'll become deluded, or we'll become enlightened. So there are people with higher knowledge, even in the mundane world, but we won't repeating his message or from his book, which is the message. And that way Krishna is speaking to us.
Yes, and I want just be in Krishna consciousness, but not to be disturbed by some people with some ideas. I doubt that these some ideas I heard that they are from Krishna.
Yeah, well, that's why you have to learn Shastra, so you find out whether they are from Krishna.
Yes, and pray and listen to Krishna. I think it's the most important.
Well, the point is
not
this.
I don't want to depend to people.
The point is this, that
Krishna,
first of all, speaks in Bhagavad Gita. That's our first source of information from Krishna himself. You may get some inspirations from within and recognize this is not ordinary, but you're a conditioned soul. You don't know everything. You're in this material world. Okay. So then you're at the beginning point. So sometimes Krishna gives us a few little flashes here and there, just to show us that there's something more than our ordinary mundane lives and mundane understandings. We get that inspiration. But now that desire that comes from having that revelation has to be directed correctly. So then Krishna immediately says, Tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadekshanti tagyana jnaninas tapadarshanaha. A tapadarshi is a person who has seen the truth. So Krishna doesn't tell Arjuna, now you just meditate, you know, within the heart and somehow or another on your own, you'll get revelation after revelation. He says, when you want to begin your spiritual life, first thing that you have to do is to find out somebody who's seen the truth. That's the guru. Yeah? And pariprasnaya means prasna, asking questions. And sevaya, you do some service. You prove that you're worthy to receive this knowledge. If you that Krishna's saying this, if you really want to know me, you go to my representative, the guru, and you serve him, and you ask the proper questions. And in that way, then you make some advancement. And when you serve Krishna's devotees correctly, humbly, submissively, with enthusiasm, Krishna within will then give you more and more revelation. So it's an external process and an internal process, simultaneously. So externally, there is a requirement that Krishna makes of anybody that wants to come into his company. He says, all right, first of all, you go to those representatives of mine and you learn how to serve nicely. You render service and you ask proper questions. That way then you make some advancement. So this is Krishna's point. At the end he says, in the 18th chapter, verse 66, he says that you give up all of the dharmas, all of the methodologies, you just surrender to me.
Yes, yeah. I agree with this.
Okay, so that process
I want to surrender to
that, that process of surrender is not something that we make up on our own. That process of surrender is what we learn from those who are already engaged fully in Krishna's service.
And what they'll tell us is what Krishna says in the Shastra. Yes. In other words, the overlying spirit is that we have to take shelter of Krishna. And we take shelter of Krishna by following his instructions. But which particular instruction, that may be given to us by Krishna's representative. But it's all based upon Krishna's instruction. That means those who are actually more in contact with Krishna can figure out exactly which instruction applies under these circumstances. But they don't make up their own instructions. They find out from the disciple succession, because they're so much in contact with the disciple succession, they can tell us exactly which Krishna's instruction we should apply. Either they hear from Krishna directly, but that's not different from hearing from the Shastra. But for ourselves, if we want to understand, then we have to rely upon Shastra, and we have to rely upon those who have given us the explanation of Shastra. But Shastra always has to be there. Either you can hear from Krishna directly, and if you can't do that, then you have to rely upon those who can either hear from Krishna directly or those who hear from Krishna from Shastra. But somewhere or another, Krishna has to be there.
Is it the same if I hear directly or from Shastra?
No, there's no difference. But you may not be able to understand, just by hearing from Shastra, exactly what's supposed to be applied under what circumstance. So therefore, if we don't have a person who can directly tell us exactly what Krishna wants us to do, then we have to, if we don't know what to do, then we have to humbly pray to Krishna,
yes,
and search through Shastra and consult with others. And then when Krishna sees we're worthy, then he'll reveal to us what we're supposed to do. And when it's perfectly clear what we're supposed to do, if we do that, then we can do it. Then that's actually our service to Krishna.
Yes.
But if we don't go through the process of consultation in a prayerful way, then it may not be service to Krishna. It may be disservice. It may be whimsical.
Yes, I agree with this. Yes.
See, there's a difference between serving Krishna and getting Krishna to serve you. We get some inspiration. We get some inspiration to figure out, should I do this or should I do that?
Yes.
Right? That means you're making Krishna your order supplier. Yeah, I want some information so I can figure out what I should be doing.
Yes.
The position of a devotee is the other way around. The devotee wants to know what Krishna wants. He wants to know what Krishna wants. Krishna, the person, he has his own desires, he has his requirements. And how can I please Krishna in that way? So that mentality is a submissive mentality. It's not using Krishna or Krishna's inspirations to figure out what I want to do. Rather, what we're trying to do is to surrender ourselves and understand, what does Krishna want? How can I please Krishna?
Question. This is my question.
Yeah.
What
okay,
does
so
Krishna
then,
want in my life, in this situation?
Not in your life,
in
his life. That's my point. It's not your life that counts, it's his life.
Your
life becomes surrendered to Krishna's life. There's a difference, yeah?
But as I said before, there's also the process of knowledge. Begins with humility, dambhivam, amadivam, dambhivam, and pridelessness, ahimsa. So we have to become nonviolent. We have to actually try to spread the message of Krishna consciousness. Ahimsa, shantir, we have to become tolerant. Arjvam, it's simple. Then,
not only me.
Everyone has to. And then,
yes.
If we become qualified, then when we approach Acharya Pasadam, then when we approach a bona fide spiritual master, we'll become qualified to understand what he's saying and apply it within our life. But if we're not humble, we're not free from false pride, we're not nonviolent, we're not simple, then whatever he says we'll misinterpret. We won't be able to really understand it properly.
Yes, but I don't feel that I should be a doormat to somebody. I don't think it's a Krishna's desire. I'm sure it's not.
You're wrong.
Yeah, no, I'm not wrong.
Lord Brahma.
Krishna doesn't want that somebody
Brahma
hurts me.
Lord Brahma, he prays that he can take birth as a blade of grass in the outskirts of Vrindavan so that the branch basis who are serving Krishna can trample on him. That is a devotee. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he prays that in my next life, let me take, even if I have to take birth as a worm in stool, let it be in the house of your devotee so that I can have that contact. That is a devotee. No, you're not. You're an ordinary living being. Now you've had a little bit of revelation, but now you learn how to use it properly. That's my point.
Yes.
Now you're
I
in the association of devotees. The opportunity is there to learn how to serve. Right, and that service has to come to the unconditional block point. Then it's real devotional service. Not that I put some limitations or conditions on it. All right, I'll do this, but I'm not going to do that. You're not going to treat me as a doormat. A real devotee doesn't matter how they're treated. Ashley Shabha Paratam Pinashvaman Adarshanam Namitam Karatuba. This is Lord Chaitanya's mood.
I think it's okay to be humble, but not to be misused.
But Rupa Goswami has told us that we have to be able to discriminate between different levels of devotees and reciprocate with them accordingly. For those who don't follow very strictly, then we may respect them within the mind, but we don't associate with them. For those who are actually following strictly under the orders of the disciples' succession and engage in worship of Krishna, either in the temple or in the Sankirtan movement, then we're supposed to cooperate with them. And for those who are more advanced in knowledge, who are more advanced in undeviated devotional service, and whose hearts are devoid of the propensity to criticize others, we're supposed to surrender to them. So yes, you shouldn't surrender to someone who's not qualified. But if someone is actually qualified and you don't surrender to them, then you're misusing your independence and you're committing offense. So you have to be, and if you surrender to someone who's not qualified,
then
you're also misusing your independence and you'll get into trouble. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn how to discriminate properly.
Who acts like people who are really humble and so. You learn it from Shastra,
you learn it from people who are qualified. Explain to you what Shastra says.
Yes, I agree.
Guess that's it. It's good luck. Srila
Prabhupada ki jai. Shalom Veda Bhakti Vrinda ki jai.